crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm Christopher Eames, coming to you from England, and I'll be stepping in on the programme for Brent today. Brent often writes many of the analysis pieces on Watch Jerusalem, while I usually stick to the archaeology articles, so we'll be focusing on archaeology for the programme today. But just before we begin here, as a side note, our college over in Oklahoma, the Herbert W. Armstrong College, invited Israel's ambassador to the U.S. Southwest, Eitan Levon, to come and give a presentation at our campus in Oklahoma. I was able to tune in to a live stream of that address together with our students over here in England. Mr. Levon gave a great presentation and described the many challenges Israel faces from Middle Eastern neighbors, groups and nations like Hamas, Hezbollah and Iran. And he also demonstrated some of the positive developments Israel's brought about to the region and to the wider world as a whole. Mr. Levon stuck around on campus that Thursday for the one of the many concerts that we host on the campus that evening in our grand concert hall, Armstrong Auditorium. This time we were keeping to a very Israeli theme, with the performance being delivered by the Jerusalem String Quartet. So they did a fantastic job. So thanks to those four members for that. Anyway, today we'll be looking at archaeology, specifically Moabite archaeology. So last week we posted an article on Watch Jerusalem on our new series, Uncovering the Bible's Buried Civilizations. If you've been following us for long, you may remember our last series, Uncovering the Bible's Buried Cities. The idea there was simple. Many times you hear about individual artifacts discovered piecemeal here and there, and our Bible's Buried Cities series zoomed out onto the entire ancient Israelite cities in general, giving a more complete context to those separate finds discovered in each city. Now, our Bible's Buried Civilizations series zooms out even further, looking at entire nations and how archaeological discoveries piece together to portray history that meshes incredibly well with the Bible, and you'll see that as we go along in the series. So again, first up, we've posted an article on the Moabites. The next one waiting on edits right now is our article on the Philistines. And then we'll proceed from there. Obviously, we'll work in the Israelites into the series, along with probably the Assyrians, Phoenicians, Edomites perhaps. We'll see how we go with that. So let's begin with running through a quick history of the Moabites before we spend most of our time discussing the most important Moabite find ever discovered, the Mesha Stela, or otherwise known as the Moabite Stone. Not only is that the most important Moabite find, it is also one of the most important biblical artifacts, and you'll see that the discovery meshes incredibly well with the biblical record. Okay, so first a quick history of the Moabite people in general. So as our listeners may be aware, the Moabites were actually linked physically to the ancient Israelites. They shared the same ancestry there through Abraham's father, Terah. Now, unfortunately, the Moabites had a rather awful beginning. Terah had a son named Haran, brother to Abraham, and Haran in turn had a son named Lot, or Abraham's nephew. Lot would later become the father to the Moabite people. Now, you may be familiar with the history of Sodom and Gomorrah, two cities that were decimated by fire from heaven as a result of the glut of sins of the people, particularly their homosexuality. And we find that in Genesis 13, verse 13, and then throughout Genesis chapter 19. Now, Lot was one of the inhabitants of the city. He was living there with his wife and his two daughters, who had been betrothed to two men in the city. And after God sent two angels to tell Lot and his family to leave the area in order to be spared from the destruction, Lot, his wife, and two daughters fled. Partway into their journey, Lot's wife looked back longingly at the city. She turned into a pillar of salt. but Lot and his two daughters managed to successfully make it out of the city. Now, Lot's daughters, having lost their betrothed husbands and having seen this immense destruction that happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, believed that, this is a quote from Genesis 19, verses 31 to 32, they believed that there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. So a terrible decision here made by Lot's two daughters, and as a result, both women became pregnant through their drunken father. Now the older daughter gave birth to Moab, and he would become the father of the Moabites. The younger gave birth to the father of the Ammonites, Ben-Ammi. Now the name Moab itself is quite interesting, and it serves as a constant reminder to this incestuous beginning for the Moabites. The name Moab, according to Strong's Concordance, is an elongated form of Ma'av, which basically means, literally, from father. Now, the specific term doesn't delineate from whose father, but it is made clear through the story. This tragic story makes very clear that this son was from his mother's father. And the subsequent birth of Moab, that would have taken place around the 19th century BC. And then our first clear view of the Moabites as a nation is during the 15th century BC, as the Israelites are moving toward the Promised Land. We have the incident with the Moabite king Balak and the false prophet Balaam. Now, if you were interested in that, we've also got an archaeological article discussing a find related to Balaam the prophet. Now, as Israel neared the Promised Land, Balak was, the king of the Moabites, was worried that Israel would come in and invade his land, and yet he needn't have been worried about the Israelites. God had actually forbidden them from invading Moab. You can find that in Deuteronomy 2 and 2 Chronicles 20. Now, during the period of the Judges, the Israelites were enslaved to the Moabites. They had their rather girthy Moabite king Eglon, and he governed from Jericho. A small ancient palatial building was actually found at Tel Jericho, and you can read about that on our website as well. And this may have been linked to his biblical summer parlor from which he ruled. Now, the Israelite Benjamite Ehud ended up killing Eglon and leading a revolt against the Moabites. He killed about 10,000 of them, regaining independence for the Israelites. So some fierce conflict there between the Israelites and the Moabite people. Now, there were more troubles happening after the period of the Judges. Israel went to war against Moab under King Saul, and David himself, on the run from King Saul, actually sought refuge with the Moabites, and that was actually granted personally by the Moabite king himself. Now, during David's son Solomon's reign, Moabite women were taken to become part of the king's harem, and during the reign of King Jehoshaphat, the Moabites joined forces with the Ammonites and inhabitants of Mount Seir to battle against the kingdom of Judah. Now, the next block of history there is covered by the Misha Stela, and we'll arrive at that soon, but that just dropping down further in history. From about the 8th century BC onwards, the Moabites were under tribute to the powerful Assyrian Empire. And then finally, during the early 600s BC, the Moabite forces joined others in the region and sporadically attacking Judah. This was the time of the kingdom of Judah's demise, and it was also the time of the Moabite demise. The Moabites themselves were also taken into captivity by the Babylonian Empire. But unlike the Jews, the Moabites here practically disappeared from history. There's a small mention of them during the time of Nehemiah, but for all intents and purposes, they essentially disappear from history. So that's a brief history there of the Moabites, but now let's talk in more detail about the most significant Moabite discovery, archaeological discovery ever made, and that is the Misha Stela, or the Moabite Stone. Now, this 3-foot-high black basalt Moabite victory stone, celebrating the triumphs of the Moabite king Mesha, it was first brought to attention of the scholars in 1868, and it was found by Bedouin living to the east of the Jordan River. Now, after several failed attempts to negotiate a purchase from the Bedouin of the stone, there was a bit of a conflict between the Bedouin as to who rightly owned the stone, and unfortunately, the stone was smashed into several pieces. Now, fortunately, before this happened, a papier-mâché print, basically, or a squeeze, it's called, was taken of the Moabite stone, and that preserved the writing on the stone. So after the stone was smashed, scholars were able to take the various pieces that had been smashed and distributed around the Bedouin living in the area, and they were able to collate those and piece them back together and get nearly all of what was already preserved on the squeeze or the papier-mâché imprint that they took of the Moabite stone. So while the stone still bears much damage to it, it mostly has been pieced together. Now there's about 34 lines of text of Moabite inscription on the stone, so it makes it by far the longest Moabite inscription ever discovered, and alongside the Bible, this is the most significant and important historical text that we have for the Moabites. Most of our knowledge of the Moabites only comes from the Bible and from the Moabite stone. Not too much Not overly too much has been found in the way of Moabite archaeology. So this inscription dates to the 9th century BC, and it was, as we say, a victory stele set up to commemorate the triumph of the rebellious Moabite vassal king Mesha over the Israelite king and his armies. Now, let's go through a quick reading of this text. We won't read all of it. We'll cover some of the significant parts. Again, it does have 34 lines to this text, so it is quite a lengthy text. But it begins in the very typical egotistical manner of a king living at this time, a victorious king, and he writes, "I am Mesha, the son of Chemosh-Yati, the king of Moab from Dibon. My father was king over Moab for 30 years, and I was king after my father. And in Karko I made this high place for Chemosh, because he has delivered me from all kings, and because he has made me to look down on all my enemies. Omri was the king of Israel, and he oppressed Moab for many days, for Chemosh was angry with his land. And his son succeeded him, and he said, 'He too, I will oppress Moab.' In my days he did so, but I looked down on him and his house, and Israel has gone to ruin. Yes, it has gone to ruin forever." Okay, we'll stop there. So a few interesting things here. Obviously, the name of this ruler was Mesha. We'll see how that corresponds to the biblical personality of Mesha the Moabite. And it continues by talking about his relationship to the god Chemosh. Now, this is this also parallels what we learn in the Bible. The Moabite chief god, essentially, was Chemosh. And the Bible describes the Moabites specifically as the people of Chemosh. It also calls the god an abomination. Now, quite unfortunately, this worship of Chemosh was introduced to Israel by King Solomon. And this King Solomon was led astray by his pagan harem, as we covered. He had several Moabite women in that harem, and through them, the worship of Chemosh was brought into the land of Israel. And it wasn't actually until the righteous King Josiah came on the scene over 300 years later that the place of worship that Solomon had erected for Chemosh, and this actually wasn't very far from the temple itself, the Holy Temple, this was later destroyed, 300 years later, in fact, by the righteous King Josiah. You can read about that in 2 Kings 23. So another significant thing we've covered so far on the Mesha Stele is a reference to Omri, king of Israel. I believe this is actually the earliest archaeological mention to the land of Israel. There might be one or two more, perhaps disputed references, but we have a reference here to Omri, king of Israel, and also a reference to his son. Now, his son isn't named in this Misha Stela, but we know from the biblical text that this would have been Ahab. Now, both Omri and Ahab did, as we learn from the Bible, oppress Moab. Moab was subservient under them. But as we'll continue to read in the Misha Stela, that status quo changes under the reign of King Misha. So let's continue with this Misha Stela. Omri had taken possession of the whole land of Medeba, and he lived there in his days and half the days of his son, 40 years, but Chemosh restored it in my days. And I built Baal Meon, and I made it in it a water reservoir, and I built Kiriatim. And the men of Gad lived in the land of Ataroth from ancient times, and the king of Israel built Ataroth for himself, and I fought against the city, and I captured it, and I killed all the people from the city as a sacrifice for Chemosh and for Moab, and I brought back the fire hearth of his uncle from there, and I hauled it before the face of Chemosh in Kiriath, and I made the men of Sharon live there, as well as the men of Maharit. And Chemosh said to me, "Go take Nebo from Israel." And I went in the night, and I fought against it from the break of dawn until noon. And I took it, and I killed its whole population, 7,000 male citizens and aliens, female citizens and aliens, and servant girls. For I had put it to the ban of Ashtar Chemosh. And from there I took the vessels of Yahweh, and I hauled them before the face of Chemosh. And the king of Israel had built Jahaz, and he stayed there during his campaigns against me. And Chemosh drove him away before my face, and I took 200 men from Moab, all its division, and I led it up to Jahaz. And I have taken it in order to add it to Dibon. Okay, we'll stop there then with the Misha inscription. It does continue for several more lines. But a couple more significant things we read in this description. And one of them is a reference to the men of Gad, the men of the tribe of Gad living in the land of Ataroth. Now, we'll cover that further down in this program. This is quite an interesting story behind why the men of Gad were living in this Moabite land. So we'll cover that further down. Another interesting point is further reference to Israel. And also reference to taking the vessels of Yahweh. This is obviously the reference to the God of Israel and Chemosh taking his vessels. So another parallel there to what we find written in the Bible, the name of the God of Israel. And also we find reference to the king of Moab being from Dibon, and this was known through the Bible and known to today to be the place of Dibon, or the capital of Moab. And so this is where the king of Moab, Misha, was from. Now, the language used on this Moabite inscription, this is basically it's by far the biggest inscription from the Moabites that we see, so it tells us a lot about the language used by the Moabite people. And this language, we find, was very similar to ancient Hebrew. The differences are very minor, and they're, for example, the way the words are pluralized. In Hebrew, you'll find plurals like EM at the end of the word, and in the Moabite language, you would find EN rather than EM. So small differences like that, but between the way words are pluralized, and the Moabites would have actually been able to converse quite easily with their neighboring Israelites without even needing a translator. Now, the Misha Stela, in terms of how it parallels the Bible account, shows the Moabite point of view of the following short account in 2 Kings 3, verses 4 to 5. So we read that here. And Misha, king of Moab, was a sheepmaster, and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. But it came to pass, when Ahab was dead, that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. King Ahab was the son of Omri, and as the Misha Stela states, it was under Omri and his unnamed son, Ahab, that Moab paid tribute. So finally, this new Moabite king, Misha, that we read about in the Bible, rebelled against Israelite rule. now this newfound independence from this rebellion. And judging by the Misha Stele, it was quite a significant rebellion. Several Israelites died. But this newfound independence only lasted long enough, at least, for the Moabite king Misha to celebrate it on this victory stele. Who knows how much longer after that. But we do read about in the Bible, as 2 Kings 3 continues, that the Moabites were later punished by the combined armies of Israel, Judah, and Edom. Now, in order to stave off the attackers, the humiliated king of Moab committed a terrible act. And we read that in verse 27, quote, "Then he took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead, and he offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was a great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land." Now, we can't be sure whether this was King Misha himself from the Misha Stele, who was here offering his son as a sacrifice on his city wall to try and horrify back the invading armies. It may well have been him. Perhaps he may have died by this point, and a new king may have stepped in place, but it could well have been this very same King Misha who wrote this victory stone. We can only speculate about that. But a horrible act there committed by the king of Moab, King Misha. And this act goes to provide evidence that the Moabite god Chemosh was one that did require, shall we say, a lot of blood sacrifice. Perhaps similar to the, I believe, Ammonite god Molech. Okay, now jumping partway back into the Misha Stele, we did read about the men of Gad living in the land of Atarot. Now, why was this mentioned on the Moabite stone? Why did the king of Misha feel the need to bring up the men of Gad living in part of his land? Now, it's quite an interesting story behind that. And we can read of that in Numbers 21. Now, this is a reference back to the Exodus. And as the Israelites were approaching the Promised Land, they went to war against the Amorites. Now, we have to get this in context because the Amorites had previously taken land that belonged to the Moabites. And the Moabites had been conquered and evicted by the Amorite king Sihon. And then the Israelites came in. They didn't directly invade Moab or the remaining territory of Moab, but they did go up against the Amorites and take the Amorite land. Now, the politics behind this Israelite, Amorite, Moabite territorial exchange, you can find that described in full and intriguing detail in a quite heated dispute in Judges 11. And this is a reference to it on the Misha Stele. The men of Gad living in the land of Atarot from ancient times. So the original territory of Moab, that's what this land was, before it was taken by the Amorites. This belonged to the land of Moab. It was later taken by the Reubenites and the Gadites. We find that with the various tribal allotments given to the Israelites. And so the Israelites of the tribes of Gad and Reuben took over this land of this ancient land of Moab. And even under Israelite rule, this became known as the, quote, land of Moab. And quite interestingly, it was this fact, and also the fact that the Moabites were forbidden from entering the congregation of Israel. You can find a couple of passages in that on that in Deuteronomy 23 and Numbers 13. It was this fact and the fact that the land was still called the land of Moab under the Israelites that led the author Isabel Hill Elder to question whether Ruth was in fact a Moabite after all. Now, Ruth's quite commonly referred to as the Moabitess. And this interesting twist led the author, Isabel Hill Elder, to question whether she was a Moabitess after all, or perhaps a Reubenite, or perhaps a Gadite, as referenced on the Misha Stele, or perhaps a Levite, who the Levites weren't given territory of their own, but they were dispersed amongst the other tribes, whether she was one of these tribes after all, just living in the commonly called land of Moab. Now, if you want to do any research into that on your own, you can read that in her book, Far Above Rubies. That's Isabel Hill Elder in Far Above Rubies. Now, there's one more interesting reference on the Misha Stela. Now, as we say, as we've said before, the Misha Stela was damaged quite heavily, but there is a possible reference to the House of David in it. Line 31 is potentially quite a significant line in this inscription. And around the same time that the House of David inscription was found in Tel Dan in 1993, a stela was found there in Tel Dan mentioning the House of David. Around this time, the French scholar André Lemaire was deciphering the Misha inscription, and he found what he thought looked like the same reference on the Moabite inscription. Now, the problem was the Moabite inscription was so damaged that it was missing a D from House of David, missing the first D for David's name. But anyway, he proposed House of David as his translation, seeing that it does have precedent there on the Tel Dan stela, and seeing that throughout the Bible, David and his dynasty were referred to as the House of David. So André Lemaire proposed this as the House of David. There have been one or two other readings, but there certainly doesn't seem to be any reason to doubt Lemaire's translation of the Misha Stela here. So a very, very interesting Moabite find here. If you're if you'd like to know more about the ancient Moabites and this Misha Stela in general, you can find our article on that on the Moabites, Uncovering the Bible's Buried Civilizations. The Moabites is the title of it. You can find that on the front page of our website, Watch Jerusalem. Well, that's about all that we have time for then today. So thank you very much for listening to Watch Jerusalem, and we'll catch you next week, probably with Brent.